Good morning, everyone. We're going to go ahead and call to order the Senate Judiciary Committee. We have four bills that we're going to be hearing, and what I think I'm going to do, based on the witness signups, I think we're going to break them into pairs. Senate Bill 402, 401 and 402 will be the first two we'll deal with, and then we'll open up 403 and 697. Looking at these, there are witnesses for all of the bills, but then there are some that aren't, so I think maybe that might be a little better way. But they all have the common thread that Aaron's going to tell us about.
All right. Thank you, Chair Prasansky, members of the committee. There is a thread that sort of connects these four bills, and it's important to understand some terminology before we get started, especially on the state of the law as it stands now. Just to give sort of a basic overview, right now what determines whether or not you move up the sentencing guideline grid or become subject to mandatory minimums is whether or not the crimes occur within the same criminal episode. So, you know, if you steal a car and in the course of that do an assault and, you know, just one after the other, one after the other, one after another, that's usually not going to move you up the grid. But in the state of the law right now, and for a lot of our sort of mandatory minimum statutes, I'll use the repeat property offender statute as an example. Let's say you have somebody who just decides that they want to be a car thief. They've never really been a car thief before, and so on five consecutive nights, they steal five consecutive cars from five different people. It's not a common criminal episode. There's a break between each one. State of the law right now, that first one, that first conviction, would then make you a repeat property offender for each subsequent conviction. That would move the presumptive sentence from about 10 days to about 13 months. Now, the modification that all of these bills are proposing in sort of different ways is to change that language of previous conviction to mean previous conviction is a conviction that was entered before the commission of the current crime of conviction. What that ends up meaning is that that old standard of whether or not it's done in one criminal episode goes away, and what you have left is when it was sentenced. So if you, that person who stole five cars, if they find themselves being sentenced, they won't move up the grid. They get sentenced on one as a first-time offender and basically get sentenced on each, first-time offender. So the repeat property offender statute wouldn't kick in until they'd been sentenced, done whatever time they were going to do, gotten out, and then if they stole another car, that would trigger it. So for 401 of the four proposed bills is the broadest. It would insert that language into the sentencing grid itself, so any sentencing that was governed by the grid would have the new definition of previous conviction. It also explicitly inserts that language into ORS 137717, which is the repeat property offender statute, 615.803, which pertains to aggravated identity theft, ORS 475.933, which is certain drug crimes, and finally, ORS 167.500. We'll be considering Senate Bill 402 simultaneously with 401. 402 does more or less the same thing I just described for 401. The salient difference is that 402 confines its terminology to defendants who are under the 18 years of age at the time the crime is committed.
Your example of the car thief, that would also, let's say he has stolen five cars in a 8-month period and is finally caught. So that same standard would apply there as well.
Chair Prasansky and Senator Cruz, that would really depend. If you ended up in a situation where what you basically had was one prosecution, one trial, and ultimately one sentencing, then yes, that's how it would work. So what would, I mean, if he stole one, got caught, got convicted, stole another one, got caught, got convicted, then you'd start seeing repeat property offender sentences imposed. Otherwise, if he only gets caught the one time and there's one prosecution, that's right. It would be, in this example, presumptive probation five times over.
Okay, Ms. Chair. So, I mean, what I'm trying to get my hands around here is, because quite often people don't get caught the first time they do something, and so he could actually be in the business and finally caught, and it's all rolled into one, and he's treated, even though his conduct may be habitual, he's treated as a first-time offender, correct?
Under the bill.
Under bill, and again, who that would apply to is what varies from bill to bill. Under 401, it would be plenary. It would apply to everyone. Under 402, that would only apply to juveniles.
Thank you.
Senator Wissett.
Just following on the same line of question for counsel, then it would seem that practically if you had someone who had been robbing or stealing cars over a period of several months, it would virtually require the court to have separate trials in order to use the repeat defender or the repeat offender statute if we were to include this. I mean, is there a fiscal on this? Because it would certainly seem to me it would require, if the district attorney wanted to go after a repeat offender status, they'd have to have two trials.
Chair Prezonsky, Senator Whitsett, the sort of strategic modifications you'd see from the state and the defense on this are hard to predict now. I do think you would see some modification practices on both parties, but it would be speculation to be too specific about how you'd see trials broken up, not broken up. As for the matter of the fiscal, this is a public hearing, so one hasn't been ordered at this point, but I anticipate that there would be some fiscal analysis of all four of these bills that would be required.
I hope so. Thank you.
And just in response to that, Senator Wissett, what I think would be the most likely outcome is that if the prosecutors decided to charge these as separate for separate trials, then you'd have kind of a global settlement that would probably be entered into, and they would take in consideration, and more than likely they would have in their presentation that would be countered, of course, by the defense, would be we will treat these as repeat but only for certain ones, and they would come up with whatever their global settlement. That's not uncommon that you have somebody that may be charged separately now for separate events from different times, and the prosecutor will be either approached or they will approach the defense and say, why don't we see if we can't take care of all of these at once and do away with having separate trials. So that's I think what Aaron's referring to is it's too hard to really say what, but I know today that's common practice.
Thank you.
All right, let's see. Let's go ahead and get started with the testimony. I'm going to call up Gil Meyer and Mark Blackman. And again, I'm opening up. We do have a public hearing opened up on Senate Bill 401 and 402. So if there's differences that you want to bring to our attention regarding either of the two bills, just make certain that you refer to which one. I think it's pretty straightforward, either minors or non-minors, but just in case.
Thank you. Chair Prezonsky, members of the committee, good morning. Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. And with me today is Mark Blackman. He is one of our members. Formerly, I might add, my boss. I used to work with him. But
no one has ever been Ms. Meyer's boss.
He is, I asked him particularly to come because he's got one of those very clear, lucid brains and knows how to really take very complex concepts and distill them down to simple thinking. In addition, Mr. Blackman's been a practitioner in the area of criminal law for 37 years. He initially was a United States attorney, now does criminal defense work in both the federal system and the state system here in Oregon, and he does it regionally throughout many different counties. So it would be good, I think, to have Mr. Blackman's perspective of how 401, and I will address my comments right now to 401, really is modeled more after the system that they use in the federal system and how they calculate criminal history under the federal sentencing guidelines. In my submittal, I offered up some phraseology that I hope will be helpful and not confusing to the committee. It's lingo taken from the custody world, and I'm trying to employ it here to the sentencing world, and I'm hoping it's helpful. The concept being first custody cycles versus second, third, or fourth custody cycles. And the concept being, of course, regardless of how many crimes you may have committed how many times have you been before the court and have had judicial intervention and punishment before you've committed subsequent crimes and then are again in front of the court again? So if you are in front of the court for the very first time, that would be your first custody cycle. If you get out, repeat that conduct, get apprehended, arrested, and punished again, that would be your second custody cycle. So 401 talks about calculating criminal histories more in terms of that, How many prior times were you apprehended and convicted prior to the time that you were sentenced on the current charge? At this point, I'd like to give the microphone over to Mr. Blackman, and I'm here just for cleanup.
Good morning, members of the committee, Chair Prozanski. Thank you very much for giving me this opportunity. Before I actually get into the concepts underlying 401 and 402, I do want to talk about the concepts that surround sentencing,
Mark,
irrespective.
I need you to just put your name on the record, please.
Oh, I'm sorry. Mark Blackman, B-L-A-C-K-M-A-N.
Thank you.
Thank you. These bills deal only with the calculation of criminal history. They do not necessarily translate into sentencing issues. And there are many, many other statutes and rules that guide the court in actually determining a sentence. So, for example, based on some of the questions that were asked of committee counsel before we were invited to the table here, for example, in the car thief example, the statutes provide for consecutive sentencing for offenses that have different victims. So if someone in 5 days or over 8 months were to steal five different people's cars and in one judicial proceeding be found accountable for that, even if you change the criminal history rule as 401 and 402 would do, the court would still have the authority to grant to impose consecutive sentences on all five of those counts. And those consecutive sentences could add up to easily the kind of time that we're talking about that would be mandated under the presumptive guidelines the way we currently compute criminal history. So it's important to keep the idea of criminal history separate and apart from the sentencing. The same is true for departure sentencing. Under our guideline rules, the court can impose an upward departure, a longer sentence than the guidelines would provide, if there are certain circumstances. One of those is persistent involvement in criminal conduct. Again, the circumstance that was described before our testimony began would entitle the court to impose an upward departure, a longer sentence, irrespective of the continuation of the person's criminal history. So what 401 and 402 attempt to do is really, as Ms. Meyer just said, look not at the formality of the indictment. In other words, has the defendant been charged in multiple counts or in separate combined counts in determining what the presumptive sentence would be if convicted of multiple offenses, but rather, has this defendant been before the court before? And if not, that person, for penological purposes, is treated as a first-time offender, whether he or she is convicted of four counts, or three counts, or one count. And in many offenses, the ability to allege it in various ways so that it can result in multiple counts as opposed to a single count is really a matter of just the imagination of the grand jury and the prosecutor that is presenting the case. And so you don't really have an accurate picture of whether this defendant has or has not had the benefit of prior interventions. I'm assuming you're all familiar with the guideline grid and the way the criminal history calculation can be changed by prior convictions, and how under our current system, because of our Supreme Court's interpretation of the guideline rules in the Buchholz case, a first-time offender who is found guilty of multiple offenses is, for the last offense being sentenced at the same judicial proceeding for the first time ever before a court, treated as if he were the same person who'd been before the court and convicted and sentenced, say, four separate times by four different judges. Those two people are qualitatively different. And what 401 and 402 do is say there is a qualitative difference. If someone has had the chance and not learned their lesson, they should be treated more harshly than the person who has never before been called on account. And that is, as Ms. Meyer pointed out, the system that has been used by the federal sentencing guidelines for 25 years. There's nothing radical about looking at judicial proceedings as the basis for determining whether someone has had a prior conviction or not. It is the system that has been used in the federal system quite effectively. So if someone is indicted in multiple counts in the federal court and has never been convicted in any court before, that person is treated as a first-time offender for the entire sentencing criminal history determination. If that person has been convicted in state court of anything, then that counts as a prior conviction. If they've been previously convicted in a federal court proceeding, that counts as a prior conviction. But if in a single judicial proceeding the person is convicted of one count or four counts, the punishment is based on the criminal history that that person brought to the table when they were charged, not the criminal history they leave the table with. And of course, it's the criminal history that they come to the table with that we believe is really pertinent to determining that person's criminal history. So I do think that this bill, or these two bills, really do accomplish a very important penological goal, which is to measure the punishment by whether or not someone has shown in the past an inability to conform after being given an opportunity or punished. If they haven't learned their lesson, this says you will be treated more harshly on the criminal history score. But if you haven't, and this is your first time before the court, and you learn your lesson, then the fact that, you know, they were able to manufacture an indictment that has multiple counts in it won't be counted against you. So, if there are any questions, I would be happy to.
Just one part of clarification. If under the federal system, if they had, and I know they do have sentencing guidelines.
Yes.
My understanding from what you're saying is that once they would go through the court, and if they were treated, this is their very first time to ever be before the court, they would get multiple convictions. And so if they came back before the court a second time, then they would be counting each of those to rank them as to their criminal history.
Chair Prudensky, as many federal matters, it's much more complicated than that. But the federal system looks at prior sentences in computing criminal history. So if in that first proceeding, let's say someone had a conviction in state court and received a 13-month sentence, then they're prosecuted in federal court. That 13-month sentence would give them 3 points on their criminal history score,
okay,
which would put them in criminal history 2, I believe. If they had another prior conviction where they got 60 days, that would add another point. That would put them in criminal history category 3.
Let me change the scenario for this bill or these bills. If they came in front of the state court the first time, they had 5 instances, they're treated all as one under 401. When they came back a second court intervention, new charges, new trials, they would be starting off with 4 prior or 5 prior convictions for the guidelines purposes?
I believe that they would be, under this bill, having a single prior conviction. The judgment, you see, in my written testimony, I recommend that the committee consider replacing the word conviction in the definition of previous conviction with the word judgment, because the courts have found the word conviction very confusing. But if there were separate judgments entered, there would be separate points on the criminal history score. If it was all in a single judgment, I believe under this bill, or these two bills, that would not enhance the criminal history.
Okay, thank you. Other questions, comments? Senator Wissa.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It seems to me that each criminal offense requires a conscious effort on the, or a conscious decision on the part of the offender to break the law, whether it be to steal or to cheat or to burgle or to rob. They have to make a conscious decision to do that. So I struggle with this concept, other than In just briefly looking through both of your testimony, written testimony, it appears that the, to me, that the real issue here may be that this, the way the law is currently applied may give undue influence to the prosecutor on the outcome of the case. That be a fair assumption?
Chair Brzezinski, Senator Whitsitt, there's certainly some tactical benefit to the current system for the prosecution, because the manner in which the charges are brought can play a major role in the presumptive sentence that someone is facing, which can have a major impact on things like plea negotiations, because if someone is in multiple counts looking at having their criminal history adjusted up to, say, D, having never been in trouble before, that person may be well concerned about persisting in a claim of innocence, because if they lose, their sentence would be presumptively much more harsh. But the real difference between this approach of 401 and 402 and the current approach has nothing to do with that. It really has to do with,
are we punishing people because of simply what they did? Or are we punishing them because of their
amenability or lack of amenability to accountability once they've been found guilty? So,
again,
much of my experience as a parent to my work as a lawyer. And if my kids are out doing something and they don't get caught and they don't get sanctioned, the fact that they have done it two or three times before they're caught really doesn't have much to do with whether they're capable of learning a lesson and behaving themselves in the future. It's the fact that, okay, you now, I caught you, now you're grounded, whatever the consequence is. If the my kid goes out and does it again, it's much more harsh sanction. If the first time I catch him, he says, well, you know, I've done this five more times, it's not something that I believe he's going to learn a lesson from if I say, well, if you don't told me you'd only done it once, I'd ground you for a week, but now you told me you did it five times in addition to that, so now, you know, you're grounded for 6 months. So I believe all the studies show that it's the response to the intervention that tells the tale. It's not the history that comes to the first intervention. And this really does focus on, has the person had an opportunity to learn their lesson? And again, many of these, in reality, these cases relate to things like property crimes and drug possession and distribution crimes, where you're dealing with the underlying issue is an addiction issue, and the person hasn't been caught, as it were, until, you know, they have stolen many times or been found in possession of multiple drugs. But one intervention may well save that person and save the system from having that person return to the life of addiction and crime. And what we do here in 401 and 402 is we say, you know, if you were a meth addict and were identified as having, as I personally experienced as a victim this Christmas season, had someone used, you know, you got my credit card information and you bought five color TVs at Fred Meyer's all over the Portland metropolitan area posing as Mark Blackman, and you did it because you were a meth addict. The fact that you went to the Fred Meyer in Tualatin and then the Fred Meyer in Burlingame and then the Fred Meyer in somewhere in Washington County, that would not mean that, you know, that 50 TV, you're in prison for 13 months. It means that if you would be a Category I offender for that before we caught you, and you're eligible for probation and treatment, and you respond to treatment, and you kick the habit, guess what? You're not going to prison. That's what we think this bill accomplishes, and we think that's, if you want to talk about fiscal impact, very cost-saving.
Other questions?
I have one, Chair.
Go ahead, Councilor. Senator Bohmici next.
All right. Thank you, Chair Brzezinski. And
again, thank you for your presentation. So as I see it with this bill, you have, like, the kind of person you just talked about, and another type of case I've seen a lot is somebody who has legitimate pain injury and gets prescribed something like hydrocodone, and then they're weaned off of it ineffectively. Then they run all over town with a doctor's script forging, you know, just to get more of the stuff, and they had a legitimate pain issue, and the next thing you know, they're facing 30 counts of identity theft, each one on a different day. And then on the other hand, you've got, and those people often have no criminal history, but then on the other hand, you could have somebody who, you know, not the five cars example, but somebody who's running a chop shop, runs it fairly successfully, has stolen cars brought to a property, strips them, and then sells the catalytic converter, sells the engine. I mean, that's the sort of case prosecutors see a fair amount, too, and those individuals often don't have substantial or repo criminal histories because they haven't been caught yet. Now, under the existing system, I note that all of the crimes that are being discussed here are not crimes of explicit mandatory minimums. Judges are currently free to make downward departures on the basis of amenability to treatment or not having a substantial criminal history. And my understanding is, for the most part, they do regularly make downward departures from repo sentences and craft probation deals to try to reflect the fact that a defendant doesn't have criminal history. But that also leaves them free with the guy with the chop shop to say, you know what, this isn't the same sort of thing. This does require the imposition of a repo sentence. And plus, judges are free to sort of hang a prison sentence over somebody's head when they make a downward departure. They say, I'll take a chance on you, but if you screw this up, you're going to do the time you would have done initially. So I in the example I gave at the beginning, you stated that this governs just sentencing grid considerations. It doesn't govern sentencing, and there are other methods of getting to that same result. But what I'd note, even in that example, is that to get to a repeat property offender sentence, you know, first time is presumptive 10 days, and then the next four would be 13 each for 52 months. An upward departure is only going to get you to 6 months and requires judicial findings and is unlikely to happen on all of those counts. So you sort of lose that hook of holding that time over somebody's head. More than that, you can't get to a repo sentence anyhow on an upward departure. The months just aren't there. So I suppose my rather long-winded question is, how would the new system, which takes away this judicial angle to sort of account for different fact patterns to distinguish between the person who has a meth addiction, their life is spiraling out of control, and then the guy who's chopping up cars and selling them. I mean, it seems like that's a loss of discretion that actually takes away judicial flexibility, even in a world where we can file for an upward departure.
Chair Brzezinski, counsel, not. It's very difficult not to want to get into the details, but I don't think it would be advance the discussion in a very helpful way. I will say, though, that the person who's running a chop shop is committing a very different crime and is exposed to a very different offense level on the other grid axis. And so, you know, the question here, and before the committee today in these bills, is what is an accurate assessment of a person's criminal history? And historically, that means that that person has, you have a criminal history because you have been found guilty beyond a reasonable doubt of having done something bad. It doesn't mean that you have done something bad that nobody knows about. If we were to base sentencing on true criminal history, without any regard to judicial proceedings, then this guy would say, well, it doesn't matter if you've ever been prosecuted before. It doesn't matter if you're being prosecuted now. If there's evidence that you stole a car before, you were never prosecuted for it, well, you're not a first-time offender. Even if you're only prosecuted for a single time, a single car in this case. So what we're really talking about here is what is, as a general rule, because the guidelines are merely general rules. The court can always depart for good reasons. But they are supposed to give guidance to the court so that it knows in the vast majority of cases what the sentence should be so that we have some consistency throughout the system and we don't have a vast difference based just on different judges' views of different things. And in the criminal history piece of that very complicated decision about what punishment is appropriate for this person for the conduct for which he is being or she is being punished, the piece that goes into the criminal history part, not all the other things, the criminal history part, we believe is accurately reflected by whether that person has been before the court before and punished, as and if not, then what brought the person before the court on this occasion should not change through from count one to count two to count three. It's just not appropriate, I don't think, to try to focus all of the sentencing issues on the criminal history piece of that formula. This bill just addresses the formula with respect to criminal history, which we believe it accurately conveys what a person's history truly is for those purposes. All the other factors, if they have in fact been, you know, unprosecuted, but you can show persistent involvement in criminal activity, the court can depart for that. So, you know, that's how you make those distinctions.
Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Blackman. I was looking at your written testimony, and you mentioned this also about the different definitions of conviction, which for this purpose are apparently two different times, the time that there's the actual finding of guilt by plea or verdict and then the time that the court enters the judgment of conviction. Is that correct?
Yes.
And I understand that there are two different times, and maybe for clarity it would make a difference in the way the bill is worded, but for policy reasons, does it make a difference between those two times? And would there be a time that somebody was found guilty where there wasn't a judgment of conviction?
Again, the reason the word conviction is confusing, excuse me, Chair Brzezinski, Senator Bonamici, the reason the word is confusing is that, let's say you have a trial and the jury, as a matter of fact, finds the person guilty. That is considered a conviction. That person is convicted. But they haven't had a judgment entered. Okay. So if you use the word conviction, unless the don't know how the courts will look at legislative history and trying to interpret these statutes if they were to pass, but if the jury says, Mr. Blackman, you're guilty on count one, you're guilty on count two, you're guilty on count three, the word conviction could mean that a court would say, well, the jury found you convicted you on count one before it convicted you on count two and before it convicted you on count three. So on count three, you have two prior convictions. The jury finding does mean conviction in many settings. It is not an official judgment until the court says, the jury having found you guilty on counts one, two, and three, judgment is hereby imposed. And then there's a written document called judgment, which sets out the sentence. And I believe for clarity purposes, and I believe what the intention of these bills is to focus the criminal history calculation on that judicial pronouncement of judgment, not on the finding of guilt. And by replacing the word judgment for the word conviction, I think that becomes much clearer, even though that explanation probably wasn't as clear as I hoped it would be.
You have a follow-up, if I may, Mr. Chair? I'm just trying to figure out if it would make a difference from a policy perspective. Is there a time when there could be the conviction by the jury that where there wouldn't be an entry of that judgment? Do the courts always enter a judgment if there's a conviction found by a jury?
Yes, but if it becomes a conviction for purposes of criminal history upon the announcement of the verdict, you see, then it's already
understood.
That's what it's trying.
Right.
That's it's trying to just avoid having that word conviction in that sense confuse the issue.
All right, let me do a time check here. I've got about 50 minutes before we're out. We got two more bills after this, so I'd like to measure your testimony as to what else we have before us. So if there's anything else you need to add, fine. If not, I'm going to ask the opponents to come up on this one, then we'll come back on the next one.
Thank you very much for your
time. Thank you. Doug and Chuck, if y'all would come up. And is there anyone else who wants to give testimony today on Senate Bill 401 or 402? Thank you.
Otherwise, he wants to clean up.
I guess so. Thank you, Chair.
You know, it's really hard when you have two prosecutors there. Who gets to do the closing?
Yes, we've dealt with that on occasion in major trials. Thank you, Chair Przonski and members of the committee. My name is Chuck French. I'm a senior deputy district attorney in Multnomah County. I appreciate the opportunity to come here and talk to you about these bills. I've listened with interest to what the proponents of the bill have to say. I think it's a very interesting conversation. The first thing I would want to talk about is the public policy aspects of this and go over very briefly the history of the sentencing guidelines and how this, how the prior convictions and the current treatment of prior convictions have occurred. Sentencing guidelines have been around now for 22 years. For most of that period of time, under two cases, State versus Miller and State versus Buchholz, which clarified the fact that the prior convictions can accumulate within one judicial proceeding as long as those prior convictions arose out of separate criminal incidents, that they could be considered separately for purposes of sentencing guidelines calculations. That policy has been in effect for 18 years since those cases were decided. The effect of that policy, which largely deals with property offenses, has not been in any way, I think, that could possibly be considered an egregious treatment of property offenders. In fact, the state of Oregon probably has one of the lowest rates of incarceration of property offenders in the country. When I took a look at the statistics this morning from the Department of Corrections, of the almost 14,000 inmates who were in the state penitentiary system, just 2,300 of them were property offenders, or about 17%. So effectively, the policy which to which the opponents or the proponents of this bill have been have seemed to imply has been maladapted to the system really has not worked out that way. Property offenders in the state of Oregon are actually go to prison at a much lower rate than any other offenses, as you would expect. Approximately 14% of property offenders actually go to prison. Again, the actual impact on Department of Corrections beds is relatively small. And so I would qualify the policy that has evolved in the court system with the sentencing guidelines, Miller, Buchholz, and repeat property offenders as one which has been quite successful and one which has been quite moderate when viewed within the context of our sentencing procedures here, which are quite moderate nationwide. I think we are the 28th or 30th, the last figure in rate of incarceration of all the states in the union. So, and of those, I think probably, although I haven't verified these figures, I think we incarcerate a much lower percentage of property offenders and drug offenders of anyone, of almost any other state in the union. So the policy has worked, I believe, and it doesn't, to me, it doesn't make much sense to change that policy. It will have relatively little fiscal impact, I believe, simply because there are so few, there are so, in terms of saving, in the Department of Corrections, there are so few offenders there, and most of them, I would argue, 2,300 in the entire state of Oregon, most of them there are there because they actually deserve to be there, and most of them are there probably not because they were sentenced initially to prison, but because they were put on probation and their probation was revoked by the court for one reason or another. The actual revocations, as far as initial sentences in Department of Corrections wide, only 49% of the inmates in the Department of Corrections prisons are there because they were sentenced there by a judge on an initial sentence. Most of them are parole revocations or probation revocations. So again, the policy, I believe, for property and drug offenders has worked quite well, and I don't see a need to change it. Effectively, what we're dealing with would be a radical change in how property offenders especially are looked at, and my belief is that You know, again, this is philosophy, but it treats people differently, and it would treat people, I believe, in a manner that's that would be unfair. And just to give you a brief example, you could have a person who, as a juvenile, was convicted of a property offense, and we all know the juvenile system is more about mediation than it is about convictions, you know, in terms of the same way the adult system deals with people. That person could have a juvenile conviction and be considered one juvenile conviction, two juvenile convictions. 5 years later, 10 years later, could pick up another property offense, and that person would be considered a repeat property offender, whereas that person may not have had any problems in the prior 10 years, picked up another offense, and now is going to be treated on the sentencing guideline gridlock much more harshly than someone who may have committed 12 or 15 consecutive property offenses over a 2 or 3 week period of time but doesn't have a juvenile offense. And so effectively, again, I would say that what we're doing here is we're creating a statute which treats people conceivably much more unjustly based on prior convictions that may have occurred sometime in the past, but now you're comparing them to a person who is, I think, committee counsel was telling us, may have run a significant theft operation involving automobile parting or some other type of property offense scheme. So on those two scores, I would say that, briefly wrapping up here, that essentially the policy has worked very well in the past. There appears to be no reason that I can see to change it. We have produced a very moderate sentencing structure in Oregon that does give people an opportunity to change their lives. Most property offenders throughout the spectrum are given the opportunity to be put on probation, and only upon violation of their probation are they considered for a prison sentence in most instances. The effect of this bill would, for people who have no prior convictions and people who would presumptively be put on probation, they would, unless they commit a new crime and were actually convicted of a new crime under the terms of Senate Bill 3508, they could not be revoked on those probation unless they committed a new crime. The largest or the greatest sentence they could be afforded by a court would be 60 days. So essentially, it changes completely the way property offenders would be, multiple property offenders would be dealt with in the system, and can see no reason for that, and may be creating a situation which is very unfair to some individuals.
Doug? Chair Przanski, members of the committee, my name is Doug Parker-Root. I'm the retired district attorney from Lane County, for the record, and I currently represent the Oregon Anti-Crime Alliance. I agree with everything that Chuck just said, and shall not repeat any of that. I would tell you that the two things in sentencing guidelines that make a difference are the criminal history. We all know that. How serious is this crime? 1 through 11 up the vertical scale. And the other is across the top. It's the criminal crime seriousness up the scale. Thank you, Senator Przanski, for that look. And then the criminal history. This changes the way we've been doing criminal history for a whole long time. The criminal history scale is set by the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission in Oregon Administrative Rule 213-004-0006. They could have changed this any time they wanted to, and they have chosen not to change this. Their job is to do this work. Looked in isolation, this is a really bad idea to just go into their administrative rules and change one thing.
I'll stop there. All right, questions or comments? Let me just throw out one scenario. I kind of brought this up with Mr. Blackman. If you had a person come before the court for the first time, have multiple charges that are that they are alleged, and they are convicted of these multiple ones. If on the first time they were treated as only one time before the court,
could there not be a means that if they came before the court a second time, that each of those separate convictions could then move them across the history? And I guess what I'm looking at, Chuck, you said there's really no good reason public policy-wise to move to make any changes. But at the same time, I'm looking at, with a $3.5 billion deficit, is there something we can do to still have the accountability and that maybe have some more flexibility on the funds where we're going to want to make certain we have a holistic public safety system that's still intact? So would that be something that would be, let's say, a difference from current policy and, I guess, give, let's say, the first bite at the apple? But if you come back, everything you've already been convicted of, even though we saw this as one single episode for sentencing purposes, they will be lined up against you for your second time before the court.
Thank you, Senator Prezansky, Chair Prezansky, and members of the committee. I did not read the bill the same way that Mr. Blackman read the bill. I would read it as to essentially agreeing with what you're saying, or your proposition there, is that unless I'm misreading this, if you were convicted of five felonies in a proceeding today, were put on probation, which is what would happen, and then 3 years from now you committed another burglary, I believe you would have five felonies on your and you would move across the grid back. I don't know if Mr. Knott agrees with that or not.
Point of clarification. Yes. Thank you, Chair Prezansky. My reading of Senate Bill 401, and I'm referring to Section 1, which is sort of the preamble, states that an offender's criminal history is based on the number of felony and Class A misdemeanor convictions and juvenile adjudications in the offender's criminal history at the time the current crime of conviction is committed. The way I read that is, if you've been convicted of, say, five counts of identity theft and it was treated as all one criminal episode and you were, we say I on the grid, meaning you didn't have criminal history, 2I, 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 and you come back around, you would have five identity thefts on your record at that time. That's my reading.
Okay. All right. For the record, I agree with that for whatever that's worth.
Okay.
Doug Harkwood.
All right. Well, thank you. I'm going to have you all stand back, and we'll start our next set of public hearings. I'll ask one more time if anyone wanted to give testimony on 401 or 402. Not seeing one, we close the public hearing. We'll now open up a public hearing on the last two bills, Senate Bill 403 and Senate Bill 697.
Thank you, Chair Prezansky, members of the committee. Now, the definitions that we're working with in terms of the change on previous conviction don't change a whole lot when we move to 403 and 697, but the scope of what we're talking about has narrowed. Now we're moving to the sex crime aspects of ballot measure 73 only. Senate Bill 403 would modify the definition of previous conviction as discussed, but it would maintain the separate criminal episode standard if the current or prior conviction is for rape in the first degree, sodomy in the first degree, or unlawful penetration in the first degree. If it's another major felony sex crime other than those I just listed, previous conviction would mean a conviction entered before the commission of the current crime of conviction, which is the same definition we are using for 401 and 402. Moving to 697 would redefine previous conviction in the way we've discussed for 401 or 402 for all crimes that are applicable as predicates. These are major felony sex crimes. So to use the example before, you had somebody who was stealing five cars. This time it would be committing multiple felony sex crimes. The different criminal episode standard would go away, and we'd analyze it the way I was discussing in the overview of 401.
All right. The only proponent I have scheduled at this point is Gil Meyer. Why don't you come up, Gil? And thank you.
Thank you. Chair Prezansky, members of the committee, Gail Meyer, on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. Primarily, I'll be addressing Senate Bill 697, which is the one that would essentially amend Measure 73 to make it clear that it applies to
second custody cycle sentencings, meaning the mandatory 25-year prison term would apply for someone who is before the court for a second time. They had been convicted once, sentenced, punished, came out, sentenced again. We would support this, and we note a few things, primarily two things. Number one, we think it's consistent with statements made by the chief petitioner, Measure 73, as to what it is that Measure 73 intended to do, the population of offenders it intended to reach. And also, we think it's very consistent with the understanding of the voters of what it is they were voting for. Before I get to those details, I just want to let the committee know that during the Citizens Initiative review process on this bill that was heard over in Salem, I participated in this for a week, as did Mr. Harkleroad and others. The district attorneys that testified on behalf of the proponents of Measure 73 and defense counsel did agree on one thing. The sex offender provisions of Measure 73 will apply to almost all indictments that allege these sex crimes. And the reason why is because most indictments that allege these kind of sex crimes do allege separate criminal episodes. And the reason that they allege separate criminal episodes generally is because there's a delayed report of some sex act. So some victim has been victimized more than once. By the time that victim comes forward and makes a report, there is separate criminal episodes in that first allegation. So Measure 73 really has dramatic impact as to these sex allegations, these indictments, because it applies to almost all of them. The instances where you have a single criminal episode, sexual assault, is quite rare. The defense attorneys and the district attorneys agreed to that in the course of the Citizens Initiative review. So looking at statements made during the campaign, I do note that the chief petitioner, who is Kevin Maddox, would repeatedly claim that Measure 73 really was designed to apprehend the, quote, worst of the worst, the, quote, repeat predator, the, quote, the ones who got out and did it again. And there were multiple instances of these comments. I'm passing out for you copies of an editorial drafted by Mr. Mannix, published in the Oregonian on September 21. The Oregonian initially came out with an editorial saying, we have some grave concerns about Measure 73. We think we haven't come up with our opinion yet, but we have some concerns about it. And Mr. Mannix's response, which was published about 10 days later, says in the very first paragraph, the Measure 73 imposes mandatory 25-year sentences on the four worst categories of sex offenders. These are the serial rapists and serial child pornographers who need to be kept off the streets, and I emphasize here, and who were not rehabilitated after a first conviction. Measure 73 applies only to them for repeat convictions. There was a similar statement made before the Citizens Initiative review. There was, on the second day of that proceeding, there was panel presentations by proponents, panel presentations made by opponents. But August 10th, 2010, Mr. Mannix again made the same statement, a very similar statement, to the panel citizen jurors there. The question had been queued up, would be there be any treatment at all for first-time sex offenders? And Mr. Mannix stated, let's be clear, the major sex offenders who are convicted the first time are going to state prison. And they're going to state prison for, I'll say, 8 to 10, 12 years. It depends on the particular crime. And while in state prison, they are provided with treatment programs. They are also provided with basic education and working training, a variety of things to help them change their lives. And again, I'm emphasizing, and we're going after the person who, after that, has been released and does it again. And there were similar statements made in campaign literature that it's emphasizing they're going after the worst of the worst, emphasizing the repeat sex offender in capitals. And then there is republished here the statement in the voters pamphlet, which I think also creates that same impression, that they're talking about second custody cycle offenders. So we think, based on the campaign rhetoric, that it's consistent with statements made by the proponents as to the class of offenders that they're attempting to reach. It is not accurate to say that the worst of the worst are 15-year-old offenders who have been in foster care, victimized themselves, and now acting out sexually against others. They are not the worst of the worst. The worst of the worst are the ones who have been convicted, gone to prison, come out, and convicted again. That's where the 25-year mandatory minimum needs to set in. That is what Measure 697 does. We think that's what's consistent with what the voters understood that Measure 73 was supposed to do. As to Senate Bill 403, I understand what it's attempting to do. It's attempting to parse out forcible crimes from non-forcible crimes.
I think there's some legitimacy in that,
but I don't know that it necessarily is consistent with statements of the petitioner and the voters as to what they thought they were doing. Again, if you have your second custody cycle offenders, they are the worst of the worst, and they do deserve 25-year mandatory minimums.
Thank you. Questions?
Comments for Gilmer? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And Doug and Chuck, if you'd come back. Is there anyone else who will want to give testimony on Senate Bill 403 or Senate Bill 697? You're going to trade off this time?
Yes.
Okay.
Doug Harkle wrote, I represent the Oregon Anti-Crime Alliance. I did a lot of work on Measure 73 during that campaign. The truth of the matter is that according to the Criminal Justice Commission, on the sex portion of Measure 73, 13 offenders a year will be affected. 13. That is the worst of the worst. And by the way, there is no cost associated with that for 7 years, according to the fiscal. And the reason for that is because these offenders already get an average of about 15 years. So we're talking about the difference between 15 years and 25 years for 13 offenders a year. All Measure 73 did was adopt the same definition of criminal episode that is there in the statutes and has been there for a long, long time. And so the example that I put in several different versions of talking points goes like this. If the criminal rapes and then sodomizes the victim as part of a continuous and uninterrupted course of conduct, the definition of criminal episode, then the 25-year mandatory minimum does not apply. However, if the rape and sodomy are separated by time so that the criminal conduct is not continuous and it is interrupted, then the 25-year mandatory minimum applies to the second conviction, even though the sentencing for both crimes takes place at the same time. That, I think, is a very accurate statement of the law and will apply to 13 offenders. I would recommend that we not change what the voters voted on in this particular instance, and I don't expect any district attorney around this state to be charging 15-year-olds and sending them to prison for 25 years, nor do I expect any juvenile judge to be doing that. And I reviewed the data for the so-called sexting portion of this, using a child in display of sexually explicit conduct. I reviewed the data on that, the OGIN data, for 4 years up through 2009. And there are absolutely no horror stories in there. There were about 20, roughly, children, 15, 16, and 17-year-olds that were initially arrested under that statute, which, by the way, was passed by the legislature with a mandatory minimum of 70 months. It's not a Measure 11 crime, so to speak. And there were only two or three convictions, but there was never a second conviction. There was virtually nobody in those kids, none, who would have been subject to ballot measure 73. I thought it was pretty much a red herring. All right, I'm done.
Thank you, Chair Prusansky and members of the committee. I'll add very little to that. I review one of my jobs in the Multnomah County District Attorney's Office. Again, this is, for the record, Chuck French with Multnomah County District Attorney's Office, is to review indictments, all the indictments in the office. I would take some exception to the idea, as put forward by Ms. Barron, Meyer, that most of those, or the vast majority of those, would be multiple incident offense or indictments. I do not believe that's accurate. Most sex offense indictments that come through our office would not be multiple incident indictments, at least in my estimation, having removed all those indictments for many years now. The other thing to say, put a little bit of context, and I brought these figures up from the Department of Corrections today. There'll be 13 of these offenders every year. That's out of a total sex offender population in the Department of Corrections of over 4,400. So we're getting some context about how small this issue really is.
All right, thank you. Questions? Comments? Don't get up. I'm trying again. Let's see. Frame this as to other concerns that the legislature has. Now, based on the comments that have been put in the record, and Doug, I know you were advocating after, or I guess prior to the vote for Kevin's group, Oregon Anti-Crime Alliance. And
correct.
Ms. Myers put forward, you know, some of the statements that went into the voter pamphlet, and it appears, and when you read those, that Kevin's intent, at least was stated here, was to have this apply to someone that's been before the court and adjudicated before. Is that a fair statement?
Based on her reading of those statements, I don't remember reading any of those. Based on her reading of those statements, yes. I could certainly ask him about it.
Here's what I'm thinking as to if we're looking again as ways this is applied or not applied or when it's applied, et cetera, should it be that it would go into effect once that are, would apply to ones where there's already been an adjudication previously? In other words, where the person, when they're coming in front of the court for a second one of these offenses, meaning they've already been adjudicated 5 years ago or whenever it is, they would be in that line to receive this type of sanction as compared to one that's coming in first and you're just buckholing the convictions.
Chair Prusansky, members of the committee, I'm confident that Mr. Mannix intended to cover that setting. The measure, the way it is written, covers separate criminal episodes, and I'm confident at the time he wrote that, he chose that carefully so that it would apply to separate criminal episodes. Now, a separate criminal episode and a prior adjudication, as we all know, are two different things. I could certainly, if someone gave me copies of those things, I could certainly have a discussion with Mr. Mannix. I'm confident he'd be happy to come over here.
All right, that'd be fine. I guess this is part of the record, and Gail, if you could maybe provide Doug copies of this stuff so we can just kind of flesh that part out. Any other comments or questions, Senator?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure that Mr. Mannix's intent is really relevant. I'm not sure that Mr. Mannix's intent is relevant. It's really the letter of the text of the law that was adopted by the people that's relevant. And if you have a serial rapist or a serial child pornographer, is it really relevant whether this person has been caught and convicted before? Is that and then reoffended? Is the person who has not been caught and convicted before somehow a better person, more deserving of lenience in the court?
Chair Prusansky, Senator Whitson, the answer is obviously no, he's not a better person. And I have no problem with a 25-year sentence.
Thank you.
And if I could just add one thing to that, Chair Brzezinski and Senator Woods, as far as the bill, at least 697, is written, the person would have to have been convicted before the commission of the new offense. And the way many sex crimes are solved now, because there is DNA testing in prison, is that a person who is convicted of an offense
and then submits DNA profiles to the Department of Corrections. We get numerous cases every year in which we get hits on people who committed
offenses, who committed their offenses prior to their conviction, that would not be subject to this, under this new bill, would not be subject to the Measure 73 sentence.
All right. Thank you for the clarification. Any other comments, questions? Thank you very much. Was there anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on Senate Bill 403 or Senate Bill 697? Not seeing anyone, we're going to close that those public hearings. And that takes care of our work for today. We're scheduled to be here tomorrow at 8:30. And with that, we're adjourned.